At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Beth Ashley Smith. Beth is a psychotherapist who is on a mission to help people feel more confident and independent in their healing journey. Beth has spent 20 years combining her own lived experiences, working as a mental health nurse and her professional expertise in trauma, addiction, ADHD and relationships. As a neurodiverse, mixed-race woman who's walked her own recovery path, Beth brings empathy and understanding to her work. This week, we discuss the impact of eating disorders on sex. We talk about our sexual health, our sexual desires, and how this can change through recovery and the impact that different eating disorders can have on the way that we perceive sex and the desires that we have. This conversation is not one that often happens, and so I really appreciate speaking to Beth about this, and I hope that you enjoy our open and honest conversation, making this a conversation that isn't something to be ashamed of, but instead is something that we can talk about to ensure that we're all being healthy and happy with our sexual health. Thank you so much, Beth. It's so nice to have you on the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm glad it's Friday.
Me too. This week has felt like a very long, long, long week. So would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yeah. So in a nutshell, my name's Beth and I do lots of things, and I've been a nurse for about 20 years, and I really quickly realized I wanted more time with people. So I trained as a therapist, and my background's in addictions and eating disorders, nursing and therapy. And what I've learned along the way is that there's some really key themes that come up in both of those recoveries, which for me are trauma, neurodiversity and sex and relationships. So I've gone on to train more specifically in all of those areas because I feel they're things that probably to enable a long-term recovery, often at least one of those will need to be looked at in a bit more detail.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting, actually, that you said at the start that you specialised in eating disorders and addiction, because it's a conversation that I've had a couple of times, but never, I guess, with somebody that's worked in both. But it'd be really interesting to get your thoughts about it on the overlap between the two, because a lot of the time people say eating disorders are very like an addiction in the sense that the behaviours are quite addictive, but then other times people have said that it's very different. So I wondered what your thoughts might be.
I see them differently. Can I summarise that quickly? Probably not. But the things that I think are similar or the same with both are both of them chronic illnesses usually. So they might have acute episodes that need lots of attention and get quite risky. But often they're there for a long period of life, if not all life, and just managed or not managed really well. So that's one thing I think they have in common. The other thing that both have is there's a compulsive element with behaviours. So it's doing the same thing repeatedly, regardless of whether it's healthy, sensible, even makes you happy. It might numb emotions, it might change them, but it might not make you happy. So that's similar with both. And both of them really affect not just the individual, but all of those family and friends that are so important around us. It plays out in a different way to those people too. So I think those are some crossovers that really cover both. One more, actually. Both of them really impact physically and mentally almost on equi levels. So I think that's something that really holds the two closely together.
So I guess with that in mind, what would you say are the biggest differences?
That's really hard to summarise. It's often a felt sense that I have is that, and I'm going to be generic here, which I think can sometimes be a dangerous thing to be, and it certainly will not. What I'm about to describe is something that doesn't apply to everyone, and I'm really aware of that. But I think if we deal it more generically, something that I notice with addiction more is that there's a tendency that the behaviour, whether it's drugs, alcohol, a sexual behaviour, a shopping addiction, it tends to be to reduce or remove or hide difficult feelings and pain. Whereas I see more generically with eating disorders is that often it's more of a self-punishment or self-loathing attached to the reason for doing those behaviours is what I tend to get a feel of more.
That's really interesting. I think the reason that really interests me is because from the perspective of someone that's had an eating disorder, I would say that the behaviours I was engaging in were a way, as you described, the addiction to, yeah, to kind of hide things and stuff like that. But it never was.
No.
But in my perception of it was, I'm doing fine here. I'm numbing everything. I'm coping fine. And everyone around me was like, you're really not okay. In a similar respect, I guess, to somebody with an addiction, you might say, oh, you know, whatever you're addicted to is to numb and to cope with things. But actually everyone around you can see the behaviours that you're that you're participating in, and then actually they're not having a positive impact on you.
Sure. And I think the other thing that I'm really mindful of listening to your feedback too is, number one, when we're in these cycles, we're not conscious of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's running, it's chasing, it's suppressing, it's stilling. And in the moment, that's not very apparent. I think the other thing is it wouldn't feel like that. If I was to say to you in moments of the height of your anorexia, stop punishing yourself, or what, that would be the most awful thing I could say to you. And I wouldn't agree with that in that moment. But I think if we look at it in the chronic way that the illness plays out, that's when things start to make a bit more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I actually think, I mean, I know this wasn't like the thing that we were going to focus on today, but I think it's a really interesting conversation as well, because for me, the way that I've experienced it, and as you said, you know, this is my experience and it's not everyone's experience, but the impact of the starvation was almost like a high. And that was what I found addictive and I wanted to keep going back to. And it's almost, I mean, I have not had an addiction, so I don't want to compare it to it because I don't know what that feels like. But from, you know, my understanding and experience, it was as though the starvation caused a high, but then the kind of come down after that was really, really bad. But despite the fact I was hurting myself, I wanted to keep doing it.
Yeah, and I think you raise a valid point there, because there's overlaps with both of these and different ends of spectrums. You know, I've made a sweeping statement. It's not necessarily one that is factual. It's one that sort of plays out in experience of seeing lots of conditions. But I think something you've highlighted that is really important is that actually it's really important for me not to define people by their conditions. And the reason for that is what you've described is that part of you that was the loudest at the time was the bit that liked the high.
Mm-hmm.
But what it did is it overtook all the other parts of you. So the bit that felt awful afterwards or couldn't listen or couldn't change it, even though everything around you was telling you it was unsensible, was ignored at that part, that time. And so I think it's really important to acknowledge we're made up of different parts and we serve those at different times, sometimes even all at the same time.
Yeah. No, I think that's such a good thing. And I think this is why for me, as you said, you know, rather than defining somebody by their diagnosis or by their condition, it is so important to look at how someone's presenting in that moment.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in a similar vein, my anorexia, I didn't properly recover from that. So it moved into compulsive exercise and it moved into other things. And now I understand that actually, you know, it's more that that's my personality and I like to get hooked on things in that way. So it's being mindful of that and protecting myself against that. Whereas for some people, that might not be how their eating disorder comes about. So actually, like you said, looking at the individual rather than, oh, they've got that diagnosis, therefore they need that treatment. Yeah. Well, that was a very lovely start and caveat to the episode. So what we were going to speak more specifically about today was eating disorders and their impact on things like sex and intimacy. So I guess to start with, did you want to give, obviously, we said before, you don't really want to be generic, but maybe to give an overview of things you've seen of the impact it can have, and we can go into that in more detail.
Well, and what I would say is, and bear in mind, look, there are differences to every situation, but actually one of the things that I think is quite intriguing about thinking about sex and eating disorders is actually it's something that's quite silent. As with lots of things, when people get into sort of really acute states of an illness, it's something that's not always a focus. However, all of us are sexual beings. So what happens to that part of us, whether we make a full recovery, whether we make a half recovery, what happens to it? And that's an intrigue for me. And it's something actually that's quite sad, that it's a huge part of us that can be a really joyful part that gets silenced.
I think it's an odd one because in my experience, having open conversations about sex is, you know, it's not something that people are super kind of normalized to. And then I think on top of that, because it's a conversation about eating disorders, which are also conversations that, you know, Joe Bloggs in society also struggles to have a conversation about, it's then talking about the impact that an eating disorder has had on sex. It's like a double whammy of, this is a really awkward conversation that I don't want to go down.
Yeah. And to be clear about that, so for example, I can give you some sort of experiential insight to sex and eating disorders. So my background is I've worked in different ways with eating disorders, but my main experience is working on acute wards, where it really might be sort of the extreme end, people who are under section to receive treatment, you know, forced. It's enforced, it's not choice. So that might be people who are quite close to death at times. Sex isn't something that comes up. Having said that, people might be on that ward for a long time, up to years in extreme cases. And some of that I've done in the community as well. The other area of eating sort of I've done a lot of work with is overeating and binge presentations of eating disorders. In my experience, given especially the length of time people might be on an eating disorder ward, often it's in adolescence or early teens when we're really in our sexual exploratory phase. It's never been a topic I've heard mentioned. The only time I would hear anything in relation to sex mentioned on eating disorder wards, and this is just the wards, would be looking at fertility and how it was impacted by an eating disorder and how it might play out long term.
I would say as well, maybe the other area that it's maybe discussed is, you know, in trauma when people have had experiences like that. And I think all of that added together, it makes it, it's like you said, you know, earlier, intimacy and sex should be, you know, something that's joyful, something that's enjoyed. But when you're literally talking about it, either from, you know, a trauma angle, which obviously, you know, is going to need a significant amount of work, or looking at it from a fertility perspective, that's very much like a logistical thing. Like, you know, you've got to get better in order to have a baby sort of thing. And I know for me, whenever someone said to me, well, you've got to get better because of your fertility so you can have kids, mate, I can't even look after myself right now. Like, I have no desire to have a child whatsoever. So it's, I guess nobody talks about it in that kind of, you know, experimental, enjoyable way. And I think you raise a really good point as well, in that often, not all the time, but often eating disorders do impact people during that time where people are going through puberty or what have you. And I think a lot of people, I know for me, my eating disorder developed as a way to stunt fertility, stunt puberty, because I was not ready to become a woman. And I wanted to remain in that childlike body so that people would want to look after me and protect me in a way that meant, you know, I wasn't wanting to think about sex and stuff like that, because that felt terrifying.
No, and I think something that where that takes me in my mind is, and it's something I don't always think about, but it's a huge responsibility, your sexuality, to manage safely, to look after and ensure it's kept safe. And I wonder if we talk about that enough with children and younger people.
Yeah. I mean, in what context would you be thinking that we needed to talk about it more? Because I think you have, like, you know, sex education at school, don't you? But it's not exactly, you know, that again, I personally found, I don't know whether this is just me, but I found those lessons terrifying. The fact that I was going to have to do that one day was just a nightmare for me.
No, and I don't know the sex education agenda on in schools today, but one thing I don't hear talked about much in media, and there are things we hear about in media, let's look over the last 5 or 10 years where there's been a significant shift in acknowledging different sexualities and making space. There's been the launch of the PrEP drug, which has been a game changer in the gay community. There is talk about how to manage fertility and pregnancies or unwanted pregnancies. There's lots of talk about that. But the bit that I have a strong suspicion isn't talked about so much, and I could be wrong, it's just what I feel, is I wonder if there is as much onus on how to do healthy emotional intimacy and teaching children about that. Because giving our bodies to someone, it can be a great thing.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It can be also be a pressured thing. It can also be, like you say, a terrifying thing. And understanding the real responsibility that comes with that and the harms that can come with that, as well as the joys that can come with it or the choices we can make around it, are really important topics. Something that's come to me as we're sort of talking about the age groups and prevalence, it also is that for many who suffer with eating disorders, if it starts in adolescence, is that learning, if we're taken away or we're having to focus on our health rather than our sort of natural peer-to-peer learning and school learning, is we might miss out on that learning. So what happens when we hit early 20s or 30s and are hopefully in some sort of recovery or moving forward, is where does that information come from?
Yeah, learning, I think that was one thing I definitely noticed, was learning that ability to kind of flirt and, you know, be confident in my body and, you know, have that sort of relationship with somebody. I'd missed out on that. So then when I hit my, you know, early, late 20s and I was, you know, people were approaching me, I was just like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here, which was really, yeah, quite tricky, but then also quite an anxiety provoking thing as well.
Sure. And I think, I mean, listening to that experience, the part that always crosses my mind is, and at that point, getting used to a new body, a new healthy body that we've worked really hard to accept and work through other stuff on our own is really difficult. But allowing another in, especially if it's someone we're new to meeting, I think poses a lot of challenges.
Yeah. And when you work with people, you know, that have struggled with an eating disorder, to then, because I think building that confidence and being comfortable in your own body is really difficult. But then, you know, letting somebody else in, whether that is, you know, somebody that you maybe don't know very well, or it could be a significant other and you haven't had that intimate relationship for a long time. How do you get to a point where that is then something somebody can?
Well, that's an interesting question. And my experience is, and part of this is because I've worked sort of in the more acute end of eating disorders, is I've not had many of those discussions, which is something to really take notice of, because I have those discussions with clients in other modalities more, not a lot. What took me to working and doing training in sexology was that it was twofold. And as I've said earlier, part of it was I just started to notice it was a theme, particularly in addictions, but also anorexic clients I was working with. Because for many, they won't have had sex without the use of a substance when they hit adult life. And we could be talking about people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s that they've only had sex under the influence. So when I think and translate that to an eating disordered client, and if we look at under-eating first or, you know, that type of thing, it begs a question, is have you had sex in your healthy body, or have you had sex before consensually, or what did sex look like for you? It's almost like different phases. So that was one reason I wanted to train in sexology. And the reason I chose sexology is it looks at the whole package. It looks at the psychological, it looks at the biological, and it looks at the emotional and social ties, because I don't think sex is a straightforward thing. You know, it encompasses all aspects of us. But the other reason I wanted to train in it, or not even want, felt it was necessary to, was that when I was giving handovers or things in the therapy team I was working at the time, often people were quite surprised that I asked all my clients about how their sex life was and what sexual issues. And naturally, it opened a door for people to talk more about mm-hmm. it. My question was, why wouldn't you be asking someone about that? It's a huge aspect of our person and health. And we wouldn't be here if someone hadn't had sex, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's crucial for human life. And I just found that quite surprising, and it inspired me to go on and train in it.
And I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? Because it, even with healthcare professionals, they're like, oh my God, you're talking about sex.
Yeah.
That messaging then puts across kind of, you know, a closed book to that conversation. Whereas with you being open and saying, you know, what is your sex life like? Like, you know, do you find it difficult? Is, you know, is it something that's easy? Like, is it something that you want to work on? I feel like that would open up a space where someone could then have that conversation with you. Whereas before it's kind of, well, you know, I've got to keep that to myself, and that's something to be embarrassed about.
Sure. Yeah. And I think the other thing that I'm super aware of as we're having this conversation, particularly with eating disorders, is that up until very recently, it would focus around females, and actually eating disorders or body dysmorphias or other sort of body related mental health situations, it's not just there for women. It applies to men as well, which opens a whole different set of conversations to have.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of, I really like now when people talk about the impact of eating disorders on, you know, sexual health, they're not just saying that it causes amenorrhea, but they're also talking about the fact that it lowers testosterone and it lowers libido and things like that. Because I think that in itself brings men into the conversation, you know, rather than this is how eating disorders affect women, this is how they affect men, like this is how they infect people. And we're just putting both of those on there rather than kind of othering men in that sense. And it made me think when you just mentioned there of like something that I kind of want to ask you how you'd work through with someone, because one thing I found was from having anorexia for so long, I didn't have a sex drive. Like I was never enticed to it. And then when I started to weight restore, I got
through the roof sometimes. Yeah.
And like, how the hell do I cope with this?
Yeah.
So, yeah, what's the advice on that?
Well, I don't know if there is one bit of advice, but something I feel passionately about separate to this, which actually probably applies in the same way, is another thing I feel it's important for young people to understand is how to manage sexual desire in a healthy way, in a choice way. And actually, I wonder how that would look in the adult population of eating disorders, having some conversations like that. That's where it takes me. But I wonder what it would be like, firstly, for someone who was having the experience you've just described to openly say that to a clinician or anyone. If we've neglected our body for a long time and gone opposite to what its needs are, how easy would it be to talk about that? So number one, I want to be asking the questions. And I think, and this is something which I think I can, and probably a lot of people can do better on, is remembering to ask that question at intervals, because it will change. We change regularly. You know, even our menstrual cycle is going to affect how we feel and how our libido is if you're looking at women. Men, I'm not so sure about, you know, as well as I would being female, what changes that? So I think that's one important thing. I think another important question to ask is, what would you like your sex life or sex drive to be like? How would you like to manage it? If you could choose, what would that look like? Does it feel safe? Does it feel exciting? Does it feel frightening? You know, and start exploring feelings around it and understanding what your wants and needs are. And importantly, sex, like other things, it's a nonverbal communication. Or it can be a just nonverbal communication, which I think if you think of eating disorders or addictions, a lot of that's about nonverbal communicating. It's giving a message, it's saying something. It's where our ego's at the time. And sex is very similar to that. So if we've been used to meeting our needs by just actions sometimes for periods, it's important. It might be perhaps quite challenging to verbalize how you'd like your sex life to be, whether that's in a safe space with someone like a therapist or a close friend, let alone when it comes to being able to share that with a potential or a current sexual partner.
Yeah, and that is kind of where my brain was going as well. Yeah. In terms of the difficulty of moving, you know, when you're moving into a recovered place, not only, you know, building that self-confidence and, you know, honouring your thoughts and your emotions and things like that, but also not using sex as a way to self-sabotage.
No.
Because I think a lot of the time it can be, you know, it can be a behaviour that rather than, you know, enjoyment and stuff like that, people can use it as a way to self-sabotage. And then having those conversations with people of, you know, I actually don't like it when we do that, or you know, that makes me feel uncomfortable, I think can be a really difficult conversation to have. Because I think, you know, with a lot of people with eating disorders, you know, in my experience, it's been a lot of people pleasing. And so there's been things that, you know, there's been times where I'm not really enjoying something, but I'm like, well, they are. So we'll just carry on.
Yeah. Or, I mean, I think the flip of that is that's one thing is the people pleasing. The other thing is, and this can go hand in hand with people pleasing in a different way, is I'm sick, I can't do something.
Yeah.
Can come into it quite a lot. There's another part to that as well. And I mean, I'm thinking specifically of women now, but if you think of what malnourishment does to the body and it can stop it functioning, is something I feel is quite important as you allow your body to adapt, is thinking about what it needs and is it able to do it naturally or does it need to learn how to do it. So I think some of the things that could be quite challenging, especially if we're coming out of a period of restricted eating, is vaginal dryness. How is that going to be managed? You know, is getting used to different amounts of fat on our bodies, which as women we know we need to be healthy. We might not like it, we might take a lot of getting used to, but how does that impact sexually? You know, is it painful? Is it easy? Is it hard? You know, what are our joints doing? You know, are we able to has there been impact to our joints and skin? And thinking about things like that.
Yeah. And I think that's so important, kind of, you know, from that perspective as well, is thinking a way that it's impacted you physically, not just emotionally. You know, I think a lot of emotions can come up when thinking about this sort of thing, but, you know, equally down to the physical. And I think that's a really big part is, you know, the way that your body's changed. And I know for me, you know, over the past year or so or what have you, it's been very difficult in those moments to switch my brain off and be like, I don't need to worry about how I look right now, like I'm in the moment or what have you, because that's always my biggest concern. So that's not just going to switch off. But I don't really know where I'm going with this, but it's hard to imagine a moment where I'm not thinking about my body. So then to have that in an intimate space is kind of even more difficult, because you kind of put the pressure on not wanting to have those thoughts.
Sure. And in line with that, with something you sort of tapped on earlier about the sort of enjoyment of feeling high with hunger. But I think the other thing that allows us to continue those sort of behaviours is actually it's shutting down to other body sensations. So stomach cramps when we're hungry, struggling with constipation because we're not putting what we need in our body, and the pain associated with that. It's a worthy payoff when you're in that space of enjoying the high. But I think moving forward, as you're getting used to your hormones again and your body's recovering, learning how to enjoy sex might be quite difficult at first, because we've learned how to shut down sensation.
That is another thing that you might not have experienced before, or you might not have experienced emotion that deeply because the eating disorder has suppressed something like that for so long. So then to experience that, I think basically, you know, the thing I think that we're getting out of the conversation is there's so much new intense emotions here. And I think like a lot of people that have an eating disorder use it as a way to numb emotions.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to then face that when it's in that intimate setting. What are you thinking?
I'm putting myself in the shoes of someone that's overwhelmed in emotion and very vulnerable physically. I was just experiencing that overwhelm afresh, I guess. Some of the challenges associated with sort of exploring sexual health and pleasure as part of a recovery?
I think this conversation for me is actually quite difficult because I'm very honest on this podcast, and it's something that I'm very aware of and something that I feel quite like not uncomfortable about. But I guess it is uncomfortable.
It is uncomfortable.
Because it's so personal, and it's something that like in the world is not spoken about.
Mm.
Like having an eating disorder for 14 years has stunted my ability to connect, I guess. And I think the biggest thing for me is when you can't connect with yourself, how are you then supposed to connect with other people? And my therapist, I absolutely love and adore, but there's no way that I would feel comfortable in talking about my sex life. And I don't, that's not a slight on her at all.
No.
It's not something I've brought to the stage.
Well, that's something to pin. Let's focus on that. And it's interesting. And that was the experience I was having, is that for me, the majority of clients won't bring that to the space. So what's my responsibility as a clinician? And hands up here, I bring something else to the table when I'm doing therapy because I do have my nursing background. Mm. So I really look at the bigger picture. And I know that's something that I do. It's not necessarily all therapists, how everyone works. Everyone works in different ways, all valuable. But for me, it is important, that physical piece and how that sits with things. So I beg the question, for behaviour or physically dominated sort of mental health condition, is it my responsibility or the client's to bring that subject up and make it easily accessible? I'd say the jury's out, and I don't think there's a right or wrong or an answer to it.
That's interesting. I think it's interesting because as an individual that's experienced therapy, and I think because of the way that society is, I would say that, you know, I wouldn't bring up sex unless somebody else did. But maybe that's just because of the person that I am. So if my therapist never brought it up, I probably never would. But then I guess from the flip perspective of that, as a therapist, I guess it's like, it completely depends on the time and place, doesn't it? If someone's like talking about something and then you just randomly go, well, how's your sex life? Probably not appropriate. But I think as a therapist, I would hope that you would have an awareness of sort of, you know, when somebody's maybe directing the conversation that way, to then, I guess, not probe, but sort of
sure.
Ask questions in a certain way and see how far someone wants to go with that.
Very true. And I agree with that. I think the one thing next to that is, and you raised it yourself, and I don't think you're abnormal in what you're saying, is that I don't know how comfortable I'd feel talking about sex. I think that's quite a common feeling for many, whether it's eating disorder related or not. I don't think it's abnormal, particularly I notice with women less able to talk about sex. So how could we expect someone to raise it knowing what a difficult subject it is? And I think it's the jury's out.
But it's tricky, isn't it? Because it's a difficult conversation because we don't talk about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes it hard. If you never talk about it, then you never want to bring it up, or if you never hear other people talk about it. And I think for me, it's become a conversation more with my friends because I've changed friends and I've got friends that are more open about their sex lives and things like that. So it just feels like more of a normal conversation to have. And, you know, exploring my sexuality and things like that feels more normal because that's a lot of my friends have done, whereas there's other friends that I would never even go near the conversation with because I'm like, you don't talk about it, you don't share it with me, so that's that. So I think it's interesting. I think I would say that that's maybe on the responsibility of the therapist to bring it into conversation, or at least make the client feel like it's okay to have that conversation.
Well, I'll give you some feedback about that because this is my experience. So as I told you at the start, I was really aware that it was an area that was lacking in healthcare in general, therapy, nursing, wherever. It's something I don't feel is talked about enough. But what I've noticed is since I've done my training and it's listed as a speciality and there's some information on it on my website, I'd say a majority of clients will now talk to me about sex without me asking, number one, which was never the case before. And number two is that when I get referrals for people, it might be something completely unrelated. But what happens very frequently is clients are saying, I also understand you work with sex. Could we talk about that? So what that's telling me is there's a huge need for people to talk about sex and what they're not perhaps seeing in the media or is triggered by media that possibly we're not fulfilling all the time.
Absolutely. I would say so. I think you've hit on a really good point there of the media and what's normalized. And, you know, you only have to watch a TV program where people are having super raunchy sex. Yeah. And you're like, okay, well, clearly that's what it's supposed to be like. And I think another point that you made in terms of, you know, people don't necessarily come to you to talk about sex, but they're like, oh, I see that you do, you know, you support with that. I think that makes sense to me in terms of eating disorder recovery, because when I first come to you, I'm probably not going to be concerned about that. But as we've said, body changes, hormone changes, things like that, more self-confidence, like building self-esteem, all of that, it makes sense that people are then like, okay, what's the next step? Like, okay, I've built this self-confidence now, but now I want to go out and have a relationship, or, you know, I want to be seeing people, or I want to be confident enough to have like partnerships and stuff with other people. So it makes sense that that is a natural progression for people to go down. And I guess typically in eating disorder treatment, that's not something that is being offered. So people may get a bit stuck.
No, and I'd love to see it advertised in eating disorder services in various ways. I'd love to see that just so it's something that's in people's consciousness.
Yeah. Well, I think that kind of the support that's provided to partners within therapy, you know, if we're speaking about NHS, is very limited anyway. So to then get things like this, but I think it's a very important conversation to be having, because equally, from a different perspective, with myself and my partner, we were having a conversation the other day of, for a very long time, he wasn't my carer because he didn't, like, he refused to take on that role, and I didn't want him to do that either. Yeah. But a lot of the time people will be carers.
Yes.
And so to then switch that when someone's so unwell to it into a romantic partnership, that's nigh on impossible.
Well, and let's not forget here about the amount of single people is they're still sexual beings. So I don't even know if we need to, you know, partners, great if we could provide all of it. But even just person to person, whether they're single, adolescent, elderly, why not have it as an open subject?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, if I've known a lot of people that are single, and almost their eating disorder was a way of suppressing their sexuality.
Yeah.
And then, so I think that's another difficult thing that comes when you recover from an eating disorder, is you've then got those emotions to cope with. Yeah. And kind of, you know, unpicking that as well. It's almost as though the eating disorder is like a blanket to, I don't have to deal with all of that. And then it all comes pouring out.
And it's hard work.
Yeah.
It's hard work.
It's like you've dealt with all that stuff and then something else pops up and you're like, no, I thought this was going to be the end.
Interesting point that you raise about sort of suppressing sexuality. And again, don't ask me the reference for this, but several times recently I've been sort of looking at research or conversations from other people who have an interest in this field about, as the Western cultures have been more accepting about different sexualities and embracing gender, is that the rise of eating disorder has actually been on the decline.
Huh.
And there's a link with that. These were studies done in the States. Yeah. So it feels to me, and that's just one bit, and I couldn't quote who it was off the top of my head, but I know that it's something that I'm hearing more than once. It does make me intrigued about the link between understanding and feeling comfortable with sexuality and potentially being a factor for eating disorders.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we know from research that eating disorders are, you know, much higher in the LGBTQ community. And it makes sense, doesn't it? Because at the end of the day, your sexuality, your body, your gender, is being questioned.
Yeah.
And so, not that it makes sense that it's okay, it makes sense that it's something that you would turn to. Or, you know, if you're trans and, you know, maybe you're a man in a woman's body or what have you, you're going to try and adapt your body in that way. So I think the fact that, you know, being more accepting of things like that will absolutely have, you know, an impact on reducing eating disorders, because people will feel accepted and they won't feel that they need to suppress all those emotions or what have you through developing an eating disorder.
It's a conversation that is full and it stumps at the same time. Again and again, that is my experience of talking about sex with other healthcare professionals or in that world.
No, I think, you know, it's a different experience for me because normally in podcasts it's so flowing and what have you. And I think the reflection from this is it's a lot of food for thought.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real topic that people don't talk about enough and it needs to be spoken about more. And people need to be more comfortable in speaking about it. But equally, it just demonstrates as well of how much of a personal like topic it is. You know, whilst we should be speaking about it more, it's also very something very personal. So it's, I guess, it's not something that I want to just be like throwing around willy-nilly because it is personal to me. But equally, you know, we want to be able to have those conversations where people feel comfortable and are able to share their experience in kind of whatever capacity that is. So I really hope that people that have listened to this episode kind of hear our kind of thoughts and processes as we go through it, because I wouldn't want somebody to listen to this and be like, oh, well, they seem really confident in their sexuality and, you know, they've recovered and now they're great.
No, I think it's a lifetime's work managing sexual health. There's all aspects of health. And just to sort of capitalise on what you've just said, you know, is there's loads on media about sex, but it tends to be the extreme end. I don't see lots and lots about healthy, just sort of middle ground, self or with other sexual relations, you know, and I see little about it as a health topic, as a whole entity, thinking mind, body and soul. The valid point you raised was, I don't know what to say. That's not inappropriate because it's private. Anything we do in our bed is intimate. So if we're sleeping there, it's a private activity. If we're dreaming there, that's our sort of unconscious world unfolding without censor to a degree. Or we might be having sex there. I mean, I'm going bog standard. You could have sex anywhere. But for me, all of those things take in real sensitivity and courage to talk about. So it's how do we do that and have a real expectation that people can share in the same way they might talk about another health problem or health query or health exploration, just like any other part of themselves.
Because I think that is the thing for me is like, it's a very personal topic, therefore I only want to speak to certain people about it. But also you want to normalize the conversation so that people do feel they can have that conversation. But sometimes I think, and there's no judgment here in the slightest, but when people talk about it very openly or like their experiences and stuff, it makes me want to talk about it even less because their experiences sound so different to mine. And so I think it's more creating a space where people feel comfortable to share it with healthcare professionals, with their friends, things like that, rather than creating a space where people get a placard and shout about it in London about what they got up to last night. If people want to do that, totally fine. Like, you know, no shame about that. But also to know that you don't have to do that if you don't want to, and that actually if you have conversations with people very close to you or what have you, I guess it's more just creating a space where if someone needs to or wants to have that conversation, because I know that I have friends who, you know, are very open about their sex lives and they're the friends that I'll talk to about mine. But sometimes I'm like, oh my God, you're going to think I'm so boring because they're off and what have you.
This is it. And I'll give you a really good example of why this is so important, which I don't mind sharing, is I last year had an operation it was routine operation. What they picked up on while I was in surgery is that I had endometriosis. Now, I didn't know that. I'd been up to the doctors numerous times over the sort of a few years before with sort of acute pain at times. But one of the things I didn't realise was a symptom was pain during sex, which had built up. And I wouldn't have dreamt of or thought to even tell anyone that. But if we'd been talking about it, and I made a point of doing a post about it, because had I known that was a symptom with some of the others, I may well have been able to sort of stop some of that sickness journey before it started.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why like having the conversations is so important, because somebody would have then said to you, that's, you shouldn't be having pain, you know, in a similar vein to, you know, maybe when you're talking about your sexual experiences and you know, whatever, people can then share experiences and maybe go, oh, maybe that's not quite right. You know, have you tried this or what have you? But again, I think my main takeaway from this conversation is that it's okay if you don't want everyone to know your business.
No, absolutely.
But equally, it's so important as part of recovery that we are working through and understanding that relationship with sex in order to kind of have a full recovery, I think, because otherwise you can end up almost like stunting.
Sure. And look, sex is a gift and a joy in the right circumstances. So why would we not want to give that to our clients or give that opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Beth, thank you so much. This has been a really interesting conversation. Halfway through, I was like, oh my God, I feel like I've just told the world my deepest, darkest secrets.
But
I don't think I actually did share anything that I wouldn't want people to know. It's just it's a different conversation, I guess, to what you're used to. But I really appreciate you creating a space where I felt comfortable to do that.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Amazing. So if people want to find out more about you, whereabouts can they go to find you?
Sure. So the easiest way to find me is I'm on all the social media. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. And I've got a website, so www.bethanyashleysmith.co.uk. And there is a description of what sexology is on my webpage. If you're not sure whether it's something, if you don't know what to ask. But I think for me, if I can give anyone a gift, is sexology covers all aspects of sex. And it's part of a network, like lots of healthcare. So it might be that I'm a good port of call to do some exploring with. And it might be that we bring in other people to get specific, because it's hard to talk about these things. So just sharing is good early days.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.